Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. This week, episode 307, The Continental Congress After Yorktown. Over the last few episodes, we've covered the ongoing war in the Carolinas and the war spreading around the world. We last left the main Continental Army back in episode 300 with the surrender at Yorktown. Now, following the victory at Yorktown, the bulk of the Continental Army returned to the area around British-occupied New York City. General Washington left the army for a time. He ordered General Benjamin Lincoln to take charge of the army's movement back to New York. Washington left Yorktown on November 5th. His first stop was to visit his stepson, who was recuperating from camp fever that infected him while he was in volunteer service at Yorktown. Following the British surrender, Washington sent Jack Custis to stay with a relative not too far from Yorktown, where he could receive better care. Washington arrived there the day after leaving Yorktown, only to find Custis had died moments before his arrival. For the next few days, Washington escorted his grieving wife and daughter-in-law back to Mount Vernon. It took more than a week to get home, as every town along the way wanted to celebrate the victory at Yorktown with the commander. Washington remained at Mount Vernon for only a few days before heading on to Philadelphia. The Continental Congress was still celebrating the victory at Yorktown when Washington arrived on November 26th. Celebrations aside, Washington had some real concerns about the state of the Congress. John Hanson of Maryland had been unanimously elected president a few weeks earlier. Hanson had only been in Congress for a little over a year, and it seems that no one really wanted the job as president. The office came with a great deal of responsibility, but no power. Hanson took over from Thomas McKean of Delaware, who had only taken the office for a few months after Congress had elected Samuel Johnston. Johnston refused to take the seat, stating that he was leaving Congress to run for governor of North Carolina. When McKean took up the chair, he informed Congress that he would only remain there until the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania returned to session in the fall, where he was Chief Justice. Only a week after Hanson's election, he wrote to his son-in-law that he wanted to resign. He found the duties irksome. He did not feel well, and he thought he needed to go home. The main reason he ended up not resigning was that no one else wanted the job, and it was unclear if Congress could even seat a quorum to vote for a replacement. Attendance at Congress was also a frustration. When Washington addressed Congress on November 28th, 2 days after his arrival, three states did not even have the necessary two delegates there to vote on behalf of the states. Seven other states only had the bare minimum of two delegates present, but that meant that if those two delegates disagreed on a matter, the state could not vote. Most of the better delegates had moved on to other positions in their home states or as diplomats abroad, so Congress was really a shell of its former self. One of the president's duties was handling all the correspondence of Congress. This meant raiding state officials to beg for men, money, and supplies, as well as diplomatic and military correspondence. Hampson determined almost immediately that this was not for him, and he assigned all the work of correspondence to Congress's secretary, Charles Thompson. And to be clear, Thompson wasn't just a secretary taking Hanson's dictation. Hanson was reading and replying to all official correspondence using his own judgment. In truth, most of Congress's work had been outsourced by this time. As I mentioned back in episode 281, Congress had determined in early 1780 that it could not handle both legislative and executive duties. It created several new departments to be headed by an appointee to run the government. The only one they appointed at the time, and the most important one, was Robert Morris, who served as superintendent of finance. In Britain, the top financial position, the Minister of Treasury, was also usually the Prime Minister. So it was little surprise that Morris was seen as the effective leader of the Confederation government. Hanson held the title of president, but anyone who needed something done came to Morris. Like many capable men, Morris had grown tired of government work. As a political moderate, he had suffered near constant criticism from the radical Whigs who controlled Pennsylvania politics. He had hoped to return to private practice. Instead, he accepted this appointment, given the desperate circumstances of the country's financial system, and a belief that Morris was best suited to manage these things. Once taking the job, Morris acted aggressively. He didn't limit his own authority to financial matters. He took control of the Marine Committee and abolished the Board of Admiralty. Since the Continentals didn't really have much in the way of a navy by this point, no one really objected. Morris was also deeply involved in foreign policy, since the only hope of keeping the financial system running was with the help of foreign loans or gifts from U.S. allies. I've talked in earlier episodes about the continually growing mess that Continental finances suffered over the course of the war. The Yorktown campaign only made that worse. During the campaign, agents had scrambled everywhere to come up with money to pay for the campaign, meaning that any available dollar and any debt that could be incurred on behalf of its success was done. Now, the campaign had been successful, but the debt situation now was even worse as a result. Morris had to take some radical steps. First was a decision not to repay any debts incurred prior to January 1, 1782. The idea was that no one would accept Continental credit if they had to get behind so many other creditors to collect their money. Morris hoped that an assurance that new creditors would be at the front of the line might make those loans possible. Of course, simply telling old creditors that they would have to wait until sometime after the war for payment of anything due was not exactly something that gave new creditors confidence that they might later be pushed into that same category. Morris also made the hard choice that he would not pay the Army. Since most officers and enlisted men were already used to receiving none of their promised pay, this, I guess, wasn't a really big change in practice. But declaring to everyone that this was going to have to work for the foreseeable future without the soldiers getting paid was a real slap in the face to the military. Again, though, Morris was desperate and had to prioritize new creditors for payment. To help the Army, Morris largely gave up on relying on states to provide food and supplies for the soldiers. Instead, Morris used some of the savings from the non-payments of debt to enter into agreements directly with government contractors to provide food and supplies to the Army directly. These contracts were put out for public bid so that the Congress could get the best deal possible. Since the Continental Congress's credit was shot, Morris pinned his hopes on his new Bank of North America, which was funded through assistance provided by the King of France. Morris hoped to grow that money by getting people to invest in the bank and accept banknotes based on the specie held at the bank. Morris also issued Morris notes, which were used as currency backed by his own personal credit. And near the end of 1781, Congress finally got around to appointing the two other department heads. Robert Livingston received an appointment as Secretary of Foreign Affairs. Now, if you're not sure what the Secretary of Foreign Affairs did under the Articles of Confederation, don't feel too bad. Livingston had no idea either. He mostly learned on the job what he could not do. He could not make foreign policy decisions on behalf of the U.S. Anything he wanted to do had to go before Congress for a decision. Since Congress often did not have enough delegates for a quorum, Congress couldn't make that decision either. Livingston expressed frustration that when he brought a question to Congress, he could watch the debate, but he could not offer any advice or could not ask any questions of the body, so he very often did not get the answers he needed. He was also not allowed even to correspond directly with diplomats in other countries, nor with U.S. diplomats in Europe, if those letters involved anything related to foreign affairs. Any such letters had to go before Congress for approval before they could be sent. Livingston did get authority to hire a couple of clerks. One of those he hired was a Frenchman who had been serving in the Continental Army under General von Steuben. This appointment seemed to cause many in Congress to argue that Livingston was simply a shill for French policy. The limitations and concerns about Livingston, I don't think, really had anything to do with him personally. He was a widely respected patriot leader who had himself served in the Continental Congress for years. He was also, at this time, Chancellor of New York, a position he continued to hold in addition to his jobs as Secretary for Foreign Affairs. Congressional restrictions seemed to have more to do with the trouble of the delegates themselves letting go of any small amount of authority that they had to be given to a separate body. Now, all of this only frustrated Livingston, who really didn't want the job in the first place. To give you some idea of his frustration, in September of 1782, about a year after his appointment, he wrote a letter to Benjamin Franklin, the U.S. ambassador to France, and a peace delegate, to complain that he had not received a single letter in 6 months. This was during the time that Franklin and others were actively negotiating a peace treaty with Britain, something that was of interest to the Secretary of Foreign Affairs. As a result, Livingston did little on his own but report a few things to Congress and meet with Robert Morris. Congress's appointment for Secretary of War was even more contentious. Horatio Gates was still head of the Board of War, but since his embarrassing performance at Camden, no one really wanted him around anymore. Washington seemed to favor Philip Schuyler, since he was no longer an active general, but he was an able politician and administrator. The New England delegates, however, really disliked Schuyler. Nathaniel Greene and Henry Knox were both considered, but since they still played vital roles in the army, Greene as the southern commander and Knox as head of artillery, Congress did not want to remove them from those vital roles. In the end, they settled on General Benjamin Lincoln. The general was acting as Washington's second-in-command, but ever since his surrender at Charleston, no one seemed inclined to trust him with an independent command anyway. The consensus was that he was a great administrator, but not so much a field officer, so it seemed like a good idea to put Lincoln in this job. At the time of his appointment, Lincoln was moving the Continental Army from Yorktown back to New York. He still managed to get word of his appointment and got to Philadelphia 2 days ahead of Washington. Now, like Livingston, Lincoln had no authority to make policy on his own. His main jobs were to keep track of military men and supplies on hand and to prepare estimates of needs for future campaigns. He also ended up spending most of his time conferring with Robert Morris. Now, the other job created around this time was for Thomas Paine. The famous writer had fallen on hard times and could not seem to find anyone to give him a job. He had created quite a few enemies in Philadelphia through many of his past attacks in the press. Washington and Morris agreed that Paine would be useful as public relations for the government. He didn't have a title and his job was not publicly known. His salary would come out of funds set aside for Livingston's use in the Secret Services. Washington's stay in Philadelphia was primarily for the purpose of getting more supplies for the army. Many were convinced that Yorktown effectively ended the war. If they were reluctant to come up with money while the enemy was still an active threat to the states, they were even more reluctant now that the immediate threat seemed to be on the wane. Washington used Morris to push an agenda that would get the army what it needed. Always cautious about being seen as infringing on civil affairs, General Washington did not want to push Congress directly, but used Morris as his attack dog. Morris pushed hard for direct taxes that would fund the army. Congress refused. Congress had agreed to requiring states to provide funds to the Bank of North America for the necessary funding, and in that case, the states refused. When the first quarterly payment was due in April of 1782, the bank received nothing. After a few weeks, New Jersey sent a fraction of what it owed. Morris noted that the amount sent was enough to fund the government for about a quarter of a single day. Meanwhile, the British in New York remained active in their efforts to undermine the Congress in Philadelphia. Earlier in 1781, the British had captured a clerk by the name of Thomas Edison. Under interrogation, Edison convinced his captors that he could give them access to Congress's private records. As an assistant to Charles Thompson, the Secretary of Congress, Edison had access to documents related to the recent Silas Deane debates, internal arguments over Western territories, and problems between Congress and the French ambassador. Captain George Beckwith had become head of British intelligence in America after the capture and execution of Major John Andre. He agreed to release Edison on the promise that Edison would help to gain access to congressional records in Philadelphia. Beckwith assigned this project to James Moody, a loyalist officer. When the war began, Moody was a New Jersey farmer who had attempted to remain neutral. When he refused to take the Patriot loyalty oath, he was branded a traitor and suffered harassment and threats. In 1777, a group of patriots attempted to shoot him. Shortly after that incident, he fled to New York, where he took a commission as a lieutenant in a Loyalist regiment. Over the next couple of years, he spent most of his time performing intelligence operations in New Jersey, recruiting soldiers for the Loyalists, and even leading several raids against Patriot outposts. In 1780, he led a failed attempt to kidnap New Jersey Governor William Livingston. A little later, he helped rescue another Loyalist from prison who was facing execution. He also took prisoner several Patriot officials and militiamen during his raids into the state. As his reputation became more prominent, Patriot leaders focused on his capture. In August of 1780, while returning from a raid, Moody made it to the British fort at Bull's Ferry in New Jersey. While he was there, a troop under General Anthony Wayne captured the fort and took him prisoner. Because he was in uniform when captured, he was initially treated as a prisoner of war. But when Governor Livingston learned of his capture, he demanded Moody be tried for espionage and treason. Now, this was about the same time that Benedict Arnold had fled to the British, so the Continental mood towards spies was particularly hostile at the time. Moody was held in chains at West Point. He learned that Governor Livingston planned to prosecute the case against him personally, and that the governor had also made efforts to stack the court that would hear Moody's case, pretty much ensuring a guilty verdict. Moody realized that the way this was playing out meant that he would probably be dangling from a gallows in the very near future. Now, despite the fact that officials posted a guard inside his cell to watch him 24/7, Moody worked on an escape. He found a post half buried in the ground, and after asking for a coat to stay warm, Moody used the post to break off his handcuffs, using the coat as cover from the guard. He waited for a moment when his guard was not paying attention, then he dashed out the door, grabbing the musket of a second guard outside the door. And once he found himself outside, he was in the middle of a Continental Army camp, with alarms raised about an escaped prisoner. Rather than running for it, Moody simply shouldered the musket that he had taken from the guard and marched through camp like any other soldier. He managed to make it out of camp and spent the next few days carefully making his way back to British lines. Now, despite the close call, Moody spent the next couple of years continuing to go back to New Jersey on intelligence missions. Several times he was able to take out couriers that were carrying messages between Washington and Congress. When the British learned of this opportunity to obtain embarrassing papers from the Continental Congress, they called on Moody to carry out the plan. Now, the plan itself was brazen, but quite simple. Edison would be released and allowed to return to Philadelphia. At an agreed time, he would let the British agents into the State House, what we today call Independence Hall, providing them with the agreed documents. The men would bring them back to New Jersey and then smuggle them back to the British in New York. Now, Moody himself did not go to Philadelphia. He remained just across the river in New Jersey, while his brother John and a third Loyalist named Lawrence Marr picked up the documents. Moody had rented a room where the men could stay for the night. While there, he overheard a conversation in the tavern. A man said that there had been a plot to break into the Continental Congress's records, but that one of the conspirators had betrayed the conspiracy. It turns out that Edison blew the whistle on the action. According to Moody, Edison lost his nerve at the last minute and informed authorities. According to Edison, it was his plan all along to lure the agents in and get them captured. I think Moody's story makes more sense, since Edison did not reveal anything until the last minute, but authorities believed Edison's story and later rewarded him for his actions. Moody's brother, John, and Marr were both captured. They were both sentenced to hang as spies, but only John Moody went to the gallows. James Moody managed to escape the tavern just before a large Patriot patrol arrived in search of him. According to Moody's later account, he threw himself in a ditch, then crawled into a hay rack to avoid detection. The next day, he stole a canoe on the Delaware River and paddled upriver more than 100 miles to northern New Jersey. From there, he was able to make his way back to New York City. This final close call was the end of Moody's career as a spy. Shortly afterward, he left America and sailed for London. Now, next week, General Washington returns to New York and approves an attempt to kidnap a future King of England. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show, part of the Airwave Media Network. Thanks to my Patreon supporters in the Alexander Hamilton Club, George Davis, Mike Hager, John Salentano, Michael Mulhern, and the Sons of the American Revolution. And you can check out the Sons podcast at fastfunhistory.com. Thanks to Robert Morris Circle supporters, Chasen Harrison and Joe Kelsey. And welcome also to Jason Brook, who joined the podcast on Patreon as a Privy Council member last month. I also want to thank Blair Greenwood for a one-time gift via PayPal. For anyone listening to these podcasts in real time, I want to let you know of an upcoming live event. The North Jersey American Revolution Roundtable is holding its first annual spring symposium on Saturday, April 27th, 2024. This is an all-day event at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. They're going to have lots of great speakers on a variety of topics about the revolution in New Jersey. If you're within driving distance, I really recommend going. The cost is just $20, which also covers your lunch. You do need to RSVP in advance. If you're interested, I can let you know how to sign up for it. I do plan to be there. It seems like it's going to be a great event. Also coming up soon is the Revolutionary War Conference in the Mohawk Valley, which is scheduled for June 9th through 11th. I've been to this conference in past years. It's a really great event with really top speakers. Again, you're going to need to get tickets in advance. Again, I can give you links if you need these things. I do keep a list of all events that are coming up, as well as other regular roundtable events that are held every week. If you go to amrevrt.org, that's amrevrt.org, you can see a list that I update every single week about upcoming live events. Now, this week, we covered the events in Philadelphia after the news of Yorktown had arrived there. John Hanson became the new president. His full title was President of the United States in Congress Assembled, and this has led some trivia buffs to proclaim Hanson as the true first president of the United States. This is flawed for a few reasons. The title of president under the Articles of Confederation was really nothing like the presidency under the Constitution. Probably it's closest to what became the Speaker of the House, but I don't think the president under the Articles had even as much power as the Speaker did. It was a pretty powerless position, which is why Hanson didn't really want it, nor did anyone else. If you want to call him the first president for the sake of trivia contest, I don't think that even makes much sense. There were a bunch of other presidents before Hanson. 8 other men had served in that role before him, 5 of those after independence, meaning they were presidents of the United States. 2 of them, Hunting and McKean, were both serving after the Articles were finally adopted in early 1781. So I'm not sure why people declare Hanson to be the first one. As I said in the main show, Hanson didn't even want the job, and did even less with it than his predecessors, handing the main duties to Charles Thompson, who served as Secretary of Congress through all of the First and Second Continental Congresses. And as I also said, the real power behind the government at this point was Robert Morris, who was acting in a role similar to that of Prime Minister in Britain. One of the reasons I called one of my highest Patreon levels the Robert Morris Circle was because Morris was so critical in financing the revolution and seeing the country through these difficult financial times. Of course, Morris had his enemies. Arthur Lee, who liked to attack everyone, was a big opponent. But so was James Madison. He had been in Congress for a short time and supported some of Morris's efforts to impose taxes, but he really disliked the idea of the Bank of North America. Madison would later show his dislike of central banks when he was president, when he allowed the charter for the First Bank of the United States to expire. But I guess he had second thoughts because he later oversaw the creation of the Second Bank of the United States. The other big topic we covered this week was the attempted records heist by the loyalist James Moody. And Moody's prior activities made him a notorious loyalist who the Patriots would have loved to have hanged, as they actually did to his brother John. Moody's escape from the Patriot dragnet is a pretty impressive story. Moody was, however, devastated to learn of his brother's hanging, and that may have contributed to his decision to finally end his career as a spy after so many risky missions. He'd become quite admired by the British leadership, though. General Henry Clinton invited Moody to sail back with him to London when Clinton was recalled in the spring of 1782. After Moody arrived, he wrote an account of his adventures during the war, and it made him even more famous to the British. After the war, Moody moved to Nova Scotia, where he lived quietly for another 30 years. The captured loyalist, Lawrence Marr, was probably saved through the efforts of his family, who lived in Pennsylvania, and most of whom had joined the Patriots. Marr remained in jail for nearly 2 years under a death sentence, which was very unusual at the time. In late 1783, when the war was coming to an end, his father managed to pay a £200 fine and guarantee his son's good behavior in order to secure his release. So Marr got married, moved to western Pennsylvania, and raised a large family, living quietly for another 40 years. My book recommendation this week is The Perils of Peace, America's Struggle for Survival After Yorktown, by Thomas Fleming. The book starts with the surrender at Yorktown and covers the final years of the war in both America and Europe. It really covers well these critical final 2 years of the Revolution, and the author, Thomas Fleming, is one of the most prolific writers about the Revolution and one who I really enjoy reading. This book was first published in 2007, so if you want to read more about this particular era, get The Perils of Peace. My online recommendation is The Narrative of the Exertions and Sufferings of Lieutenant James Moody in Cause of Government Since the Year 1776 by James Moody. As I hope I emphasized in the main show, Moody was the one who led the daring raid and amazing life during the war as a loyalist in New Jersey. He wrote this narrative when he arrived in Britain in 1782. I think the main point of his writing it was the hopes of getting government compensation for his activities in America. So the events as he wrote them could be embellished or certainly put in a light more positive for himself, but the basic facts of his actions are substantiated elsewhere and confirmed by the fact that the Patriots tried so hard to catch and execute him. It's a pretty short pamphlet, only about 60 pages, and it covers much of the actions taking place in New Jersey during the war. So I really see this as a great primary source. The reprint I've linked to was published in 1865, but appears to be accurate to the original. It's, of course, in the public domain and available to everyone as a free download on archive.org and elsewhere. And as always, I've included direct links on my blog and website. My question this week comes from Ron Thorson, who asks, what was the terrain on the East Coast actually like? Was movement more through woods or farmland and on roads or trails? Or maybe neither or some combo of them all? Well, Ron, the East Coast is a pretty big spread, and like today, there were many different environments depending on where you were along the coast. Now, most of the area along the coast had been turned into farmland by the time of the Revolution. Now, many native tribes had farmed for centuries before colonization, but the colonists really pushed that a lot further. Since most people wanted to live near the coast, that area became most developed rather quickly. So if you're traveling down a road along the coast, you would probably see almost a continuous stream of fields and farmlands. There were, of course, still some forested areas that were not really suited for farming. You would also see a great deal more swampland. Americans did a great deal to drain swamps to create more farmland in the 19th century. Now, if you've ever been to any European countries, you tend to see that there are many acres of wilderness and then a relatively few areas of tightly packed villages where people live. This was because the nobles kept the commoners crammed into villages and maintained large areas of wilderness for their own use, for hunting and things like that. In America, a great deal of this land got sold and subdivided much faster, meaning that much more land was populated, although the land was populated more lightly because people weren't pressed into very tightly controlled villages. As you move further west into what is today the central parts of most East Coast states, those areas were still on the frontier during the Revolution. Now, there were some farms, but there was also a great deal more of undeveloped land that was mostly forest. So the further you moved from the coast, you'd probably see less farms and more trees. There were many roads along the East Coast by this time. These were, of course, all dirt roads. As you move further west, you would find the trails even more difficult if they existed at all. For example, we remember how much trouble Burgoyne had moving his army through central New York. That far from the coast would mean lots of forest and very few decent roads that were more than footpaths. If you have a question you'd like me to answer, please reach out to me either via email or on Twitter, Facebook, Quora, or Reddit. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.